So I will start with this, the last topic on the last talk. It was this C functions that interpolate between the central charge at the infrared to the central charge at the ultraviolet. In the problem that I proposed, you are supposed to compute the C function for a massive scalar, massive free scalar in two dimensions. And this is given by this, you should obtain something like this picture here. So you can see here I plot also the C function for a Fermi field, a Dirac field, massive Dirac field. And both of these theories have the same central charge, the violet, so it's 1/3 here. But you see that the scalar rapidly wants to be considered as a half of the Dirac field somehow. But it has to be, it is bound to have the same number at the origin. And when you do the numerical computation, you will find that very hard to reach this point, 0.33, let's say, because in fact, what you have there is that the entropy, the C function goes like 1/3 plus 1/2, 1 over log rm plus, so this is for a small rm. The logarithm will go to infinity for a small r, but and then this term will go to zero, and you get 1/3, but it's very slow, the dependence, it's very gaspy. You have to put masses like MR like 10 to the minus 10 to get the, or more, 10 to the minus 100, let's say, to get the 0.33. These functions can also be computed analytically. And these are given analytically, they are given in terms of some solutions of differential equations of Pine-Levet type, so they are nonlinear differential equations. And here I plotted, because of the last question I received yesterday, I plotted this. These are, again, the C function of the scalar of a Dirac field. These are entropic C functions. And these are the somological C function of a Dirac field and a scalar. And you see that the order is inverted. And you can also understand that with a stress tensor correlator, you can produce many other functions, not only these two, also analogous of somological C function. But the ordering here will also be that. So we will always get some function for the scalar that is bigger than the one for the Dirac field. So it means that entropic C functions know a little bit more, know different stuff. That is not in the two-point correlation of the stress tensor. In particular, for example, this gaspy behavior is related to the fact that the scalar, the real scalar, when it gets massless, in fact, it doesn't define a well-defined quantum field theory because the correlator diverges, while these functions do not notice, these somological functions do not notice that. Well, this is all what I wanted to say about C functions. I only say that you can, with the strong superadditivity, you can also prove a C theorem in 2 plus 1 dimensions, more or less analogous geometric construction that I showed yesterday. I will come back to that if we have time later, or if somebody asks a question about that. Okay, let us change to Blackboard then. I don't want to give the impression that the only possible calculations are numerical, because we are aiming to something in the continuum limit. We can use directly continuum tools to compute the entanglement entropy. And sometimes you can get some analytical results from that. So this is the tool we got for computing the entanglement entropy in the continuum directly. It's called replica trick. The idea is that this expression contains this log, and this log is very difficult to compute in general. So instead of computing this directly, one starts computing something else, which is called Rengi entropy, which are interesting in their own right, which are these quantities. So now, instead of a logarithm of rho, we have powers of rho, and they take the trace, and then we just take the logarithm of some number there. So it's a computation, the logarithm of a number. And the advantage of this, well, of these Rengi entropies, if you compute Sn and take the limit when n goes to 1, you get just the entropy. Just expanding this expression, because it has this denominator here, you expand the power here, and you get the logarithm. So the idea is then to compute this quantity for n. In fact, we have a tool to compute this for n integer. And then you have to work hard to understand how this function on integers is analytically continued for all n, and then you get in the limit of n equal to 1 the entropy. So, but how we compute then this quantity here, the traces of power of n? Then the idea is to use the path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. Let us think first in the ordinary quantum mechanics of 1 degree of freedom, not quantum field theory. So you know that you have this formula for the path integral. So this is the amplitude of transition from some point x at time t 0 to another point x 0 to x at time 0. And this is given by a path integral. Over all trajectories of x. And here in the exponential, we have the action of this trajectory. So and this is just here I can this vector that is at time t zero, I can just pull away the evolution operator, so I get x zero at time zero. All of these are at time zero. So, but this gives me the amplitude of transition between these two vectors. But I want to compute density matrix. So I will start computing the wave function of the vacuum or the fundamental state. So, and the trick for getting with the path integral the wave function of the lowest energy eigenstate is to pass to Euclidean time. So we do this weak rotation. So we put t0 here as minus I tau, with tau a real parameter, this imaginary time. And doing so, we get here an exponential of something that decreases. Now it's a real exponential. And so we can put here an expansion in the energy, an expansion in eigenvectors of the energy, and we can see that all energies that are higher than the fundamental will be exponentially suppressed. So this gets to something like x zero e to the minus e. T0, this is the energy of the fundamental state, So just plugging here a 1 that is given by the sum over the basis of the eigenstates of the energy, I get that the main contribution for large, here is tau. So the main contribution for large tau, it will be given by this expression. And this expression has x and x0, but I'm only interested in the how it depends on x0. So if you look at here, this is proportional to the wave function of the vacuum state of x times something that depends on the other boundary condition that I put to minus infinity this time. So I don't care about these constants here because I will normalize my wave function. So, but then you get that this, this wave function of the fundamental state is proportional to the integral from minus infinity to x at time 0 . Now we are in a Euclidean time, imaginary time, and the action is in general is real but can be complex, but we eliminated this because the action has a differential of t that also gives an imaginary part. So nice. We have an expression now for the vacuum wave functional in terms of the path integral. Now, in quantum field theory, one expects the same. So one has now a wave functional. It's just a quantum field theory. It's just a quantum theory of infinitely many degrees of freedom in space. So you just take this formula. And now we have some normalization constant. And the path integral from minus infinity to t equals 0 and phi at t equals 0 x is equal to this. Look at the the argument of the wave function is given by the extremal value, the boundary value in the path integral. So I put here this phi 1 that only depends on x, not on t. So this is an integral now. You know the lowest plane here, I have to put here. So I'm doing the path integral for all trajectories from minus infinity to time equals 0. And here I'm putting the as a boundary condition the argument of the wave functional in this cut there. And then with that, we can construct easily the density matrix from the vacuum state that now depends on two entries, one enters and one goes out from the matrix. And this is just the product of the ket and the bra. And the representation in terms of this type of picture is just that the product of these two things. So you have here phi 2, and you can put in the upper half plane the other path integral and give you phi 1. Phi 1 in the boundary. So it's just a cut plane with two boundary conditions here. This gives you the density matrix. But then we can think we have a region in this cut plane. This is a region B that I'm interested in computing these Rényi entropies. I have a copy of this region B here and here. And I want to compute the density matrix of the vacuum in the region V. And now will be given as a function of the variables at the boundary, but only in these intervals here. And for doing that, I will have to take the trace. So I have to integrate over phi 1 equal to phi 2. So I have to put in the complement of this region, I have to put the boundary conditions as equal because I'm taking the trace over this part and integrate over them. So what I get is a path integral now that in the whole Euclidean space, but it has a cut only here in the region V. This is the region B. And I have two boundary conditions on the different boundaries of this cut. I have phi 1b and phi 2b. Great. Then we have to compute these powers of the density matrix and take the trace. So let us take two of these. So I need two density matrices now. You take the plane with the cut. And I take another. And then I have to do this rho square of now phi 1, phi 2 in the region B will be the integral over some d phi 3 in the region B of rho 1, phi 1, phi 3. Phi 3, phi 2. So it means I have to do the first put this boundary here. I have to take the same boundary condition as to this boundary here, the upper boundary now, and integrate over them. So the result will be dependent on the boundary that is lower boundary here and the upper boundary here, but these two are identified. So if I go through here, I will end up going out from here. And then the trace, or rho square, is just simply putting this boundary value and this boundary value equal and integrating over that. So I will have to identify this boundary with this other. So I end up with a path integral without boundary conditions. It's just a number now that is the trace of rho square. But it's in this manifold with two copies and this special identification along the cut on the region B. So let's analyze how is the geometry here. So let me draw it again. Suppose I start with a point here. And I draw a circle that crosses here. Then it crosses the upper boundary. It goes out from the lower boundary and crosses again, let's say, to this boundary. So it goes out from the upper boundary. So you get here. So you just turn around and you find a perfectly nice circle without any problems. It means that for this guy that is sitting here, this space is just usual space without any kind of problems. Of course, if you have a starting from here, you will get something like this that is completed by a circle like here. So it means that near this cut doesn't exist really in the manifold. It's just a way to write down the partition function, but it doesn't exist locally. There is no cut, but there are two copies of the space because I can close it here or I can close it from below. But let us analyze what happens if you start from a point here and you want to cross here. Then you go to the lower boundary, you go up and cross here again. This is the upper boundary. You go out from the lower boundary, and then you close the circle. But as you see, this circle now has 2 times 2 pi as an angle. So around this point, the boundary point, you have to go around an angle twice the normal angle to close the circle. So, and this is called a conical singularity. And of course, if you, this we have done for only for trace of rho square. If you do the job for more trace of rho to the cube, then you have 3 copies, and you do the same thing, and you find always that you have n copies, and at the boundary of the point, you have a conical singularity of angle n times 2 pi. So, it means one has to compute the partition function in these manifolds that have conical singularities. And in general, it's not easy. But many things can be done and have been done. But one interesting point here is that it's geometrical. So the answer for this range entropy is very geometrical. It's something, it's just for any theory, it's the same thing. It's a path integral in some specific geometry that has its conical singularities. And this is related to the fact, as was proved by Maldacena and Leukowitz, that in ADS, we have this simple expression, geometrical expression, for the entanglement entropy in holography. So the first the interesting point is geometrical. So in general, it's a difficult thing to make calculations with this, but there is one special case where some that this contraction give you more insight. That is a case of I have to say also that this construction is geometrical only for integer n. So for integer n, how we construct the manifold? We take n copies, and as the mathematicians do, construct a manifold, just say, well, I identify this boundary with this, and this is my description of the manifold. If I have non-integer n, I would start saying, well, I have to take some conical singularity here with some angle given by this, but then how I complete the space in order that it's smooth everywhere is not clear, right? So only for integer n we have this construction that the manifold looks like completely flat everywhere except at the boundary of the region. So these points here, this is just an interval in 1 + 1 dimension, let's say. But in general, these points here correspond to the boundary of the region. But there is a case where you can also take n non-integer. That is a case where you have symmetry, and you have only, in fact, one boundary. So this is a case of if you take half a space. So your region, well, let me say first that to complete the formula, so I have said that trace of rho to the n is equal to the partition function in this manifold. They call it N. It's a manifold replicated N times. There is no ambiguity in how to do it. It's a particular partition function. But I have to normalize because I want that the trace of rho to the 1 is equal to 1 because it's a density matrix is normalized. So I have to normalize with set of 1 to the N. So this is the answer in terms of partition functions. And from here, and using just the formula for the Rengi entropy, we arrive that Sn is equal to log set n minus n log set 1 divided by 1 minus n. And then you can take the limit of this thing, and then it gives you something that, for the entropy, something that depends on the derivative of log set n around n equal to 1. So let me come back to the case then when I take half a space, so Rindler space, and I want to compute things in Rindler space. Any question here? So if I consider half a space, I take the cut like this, and then I close it. This is my space. I'm putting here a boundary at infinity, let's say. But in this case, this is a density matrix, so we have to put boundary condition here, and this gives me the density matrix in a region that is half a space. And as we see, we have a rotational symmetry in Euclidean space that takes me from one boundary to the other. You can think that the path integral in this manifold, you can take, instead of taking the usual time, you can take as operator, as time, the angle of rotation that goes from one side to the other. So you can express the path integral in this way. And you can express this then as that rho v is the same as phi 1 e to the minus 2 pi l. So here I'm putting the vectors living in this boundary, and I think this path integral as a time evolution, Euclidean time evolution of the operator L that is the angular momentum that produces the rotation from one boundary to the other. So it means, then what is L? L is this angular momentum, so we know that it's given by the integral for x1, let's say this is coordinate x1, greater than 0. Of what? Of the momentum times the coordinate. So it's x1. So let us write it. X1 times the momentum. And the momentum density in field theory can be written in terms of a stress tensor. And this is xt00 because it's the direction, in this direction is a time direction. So it means that we have a formula for the density matrix in this half space that is given to e to the minus 2 pi and this rotation operator acting in Euclidean space. If we understand it in Minkowski space, it's just the boost operator. It's half the boost operator because I'm integrating only for x1 greater than 0. So this is a boost operator. So there are several commentaries that one has to do here. First of all, is the fact that this only holds for relativistic quantum field theories. So this is relativistic quantum field theories. And only holds for vacuum. We have used both things, vacuum to express the density matrix in terms of the path integral, and the relativistic symmetry in order that this thing that corresponds in Minkowski space to Boost operator is a symmetry of the problem. But it holds for any quantum field theory. So it doesn't depend that the theory have masses or not or something like that. What is, if you see this result, is what is impressive is that it's given by the density matrix is given by something that is local. This exponent here, so we can always write the density matrix as an exponential. So we can always write this as e to the minus k divided by the trace to the e minus k. And this k is usually called the modular Hamiltonian. Or the entanglement Hamiltonian. So in this particular case, we have that the modular Hamiltonian is local. It's not only local, but it's expressed in terms of the stress tensor that is an object that appears for any theory. So it tells that the energy density, this T00 is just the energy density operator. The energy density in principle, it means that if you have the vacuum state for a relativistic quantum field theory and you know how to express your operators locally, you can, in principle, take from the vacuum state itself what is the Hamiltonian, the energy density. So it means this is very different from ordinary quantum mechanics, that the vacuum state is just one state and then you have to put the dynamics in as a different thing, right? Yeah. Yeah, but it's an expression that is a local operator integrated along the space, in this sense. Because in general, if you have any region or any theory, you can have, you can expand, let's say, your modular Hamiltonian as integral of some local operator, some function, then integral of product of more and more and more operators. In general, it will be completely non-local object. And one has reasons to understand why it cannot be local in general, only for very specific cases is local, the half space, and also this result can be mapped to spheres in conformal field theories. So this is half a space. If you have a conformal field theory, it's a theory that has spatial symmetries beyond the usual Poincaré symmetries of boost and rotations, and that carry half a space into spheres and always carry spheres into spheres. If we map to flat space, we can also map in this theory to other spaces like the Sitter space or hyperbolic space. But so this result of local Hamiltonian can also be mapped to other cases, for example, spheres of inconformal field theories. In that case, the modular Hamiltonian is given by the generator of symmetries in these theories that keeps the boundary fixed. You see that this symmetry, this is half a space, this time and x. So I'm thinking this is half a space, so this Hamiltonian K will be a symmetry of rho. It will commutes with rho. So if I take, for example, E to the I time K, it's like an internal time evolution that maps the thing in itself. In this case, it's just the boost trajectories, which are a symmetry of any quantum field theory in vacuum. And there is another thing that is connected to this, that is the issue of the Unruh temperature. It's known that doing calculations with free field theories, you can see that, for example, if you have an accelerated trajectory with fixed acceleration, you will see the vacuum state as thermal with the temperature, which is given by the acceleration over 2 pi. This is the Unruh result. And this is exactly what this formula is telling, because now suppose you have an accelerated observer with fixed acceleration, you can see that the trajectory of this observer will be given by these orbits under boosts. So if you apply boosts, you will describe, for example, you boost this point, you will describe this trajectory, and this is exactly the trajectory of an accelerated observer with fixed acceleration. So this fixed acceleration observer can think, well, my Hamiltonian is the boost Hamiltonian, it's the one that produces trajectories of this observer. But then, if you analyze the vacuum, you will see that that it has this, in terms of the Hamiltonian, that is the boost Hamiltonian for this accelerated observer, is like a thermal state. And so the temperature will be proportional to this x1 to pi here. This is a beta. You have to think that this is a beta. And there is a relation between, because in this picture, these trajectories have more acceleration than these other ones. In fact, the acceleration is given by, so this size to the vertex, this distance is given by a to the minus 1, so the acceleration to the minus 1. So these two pictures are exactly the same, and this is the reason why accelerated observers see a thermal state. Do you know how much time do you have? 20 minutes. Okay. So let me make an application of this. As an application, we will see how to how to prove the Bekenstein bound. Bekenstein proposed a bound for entropy of any system in 1981. And he used this simple idea that, suppose now we are in gravitational physics, we have black holes, and you take a very large black hole, astrophysical black hole, let's say, and very small object outside, very near the horizon. So this will be a black hole, and this is an object that we call O. So this is the situation A. And the situation B, you release this object that you have to pull in order that it doesn't go to the black hole. You release this object, and it crosses the horizon. So it disappears behind the horizon, but then because some matter has come into the black hole is bigger, so it increases the size. So the black hole has increased its size. So, but you, the black hole has entropy. The entropy of a black hole is given by R over 4G. And then you have also, you also think that this entropy is just ordinary entropy, but of this system that is a black hole. So it must also comply with the second law of thermodynamics, so you can count the entropy before, and it has to be less than the entropy after the object has been swallowed by the black hole. So you have that entropy of black hole initially, plus this entropy of the object. You can think this object has some entropy, is less or equal that entropy of black hole prime. But then you have, this comes from the generalized second law, which is the second law including the entropy of black holes. But these are given by the areas of the black holes, initial and final areas. These are given by the geometry. The geometry depends on the Einstein equations. So the Einstein equation will translate the change in the area in something that depends on the energy that the object has swallowed. In fact, the calculation can be done, and you get that the variation of areas here is given by some expression depending on the size of the distance to the horizon and the size of the, and the energy of the object. And so what you get at the end is that the entropy of the object has to be less or equal than 2 pi e times r. R, let's say, is the distance to the horizon. Or you can imagine r is some kind of size of the object, maximal size. So this is the Bekenstein bound. And during many years, it was discussed if this, because this is very interesting. Why? Because it doesn't contain G. So the Newton constant has disappeared from the from this in this particular limit where the object is very small and very near the horizon. So you can think, well, if this is correct, maybe it's telling something new about physics in flat space. That comes from the physical black hole, something new. And so people debated during the years if this construction was correct, or if even if this formula holds for generic systems. But then in trying to do so, you find that this thing is has ambiguities. It's not clear what it means. Why? First of all, for example, one can say, well, if I have a state, I have a well-defined notion of what is the energy. Now we are thinking in flat space, because this is an inequality that can be applied to flat space. So we have a well-defined notion of what is energy and what is entropy, but then what is R for a general quantum state? And then if you, so, if E and S are global, then what is R? So it implies boundary conditions. So we have to put boundary conditions in order to define R, what is the size of the object or not. Another thing is that that, for example, this bound, when you try to test it, you can put many states, many species of these LM particles, and with this, and you can keep the energy constant, but the entropy, because it's the number of particles grows, the entropy, you can devise states where the energy is constant, but the entropy grows as a logarithm of this volume in the number of particles, so the entropy grows without bound, and this will be violated. So this is called the species problem. And also, if you think that that this R means that the system is somehow bounded, there is a boundary, then the entropy can be divergent. So the entropy, the entanglement entropy is divergent in this case. And also, we know that for localized system, the energy in a quantum field theory can be negative, while the entropy is always positive. So energy can be negative. So a way out of this is thinking in quantum effects in this problem. So now let us simplify and think that we are very near the black hole. So it's like having a Rindler horizon, half a space in a Minkowski space. So you have your object here, and it crosses to this other half space and disappears behind this Rindler horizon. And then if you count the entropy before and after, what you get is that the entropy of after the, and you can think that you are only interested in the physics outside, because it's what we did there. So the entropy before and after the object crosses has a contribution, the entropy after it crosses has a contribution of entanglement entropy in the vacuum. So you would replace S of object by the S of the region V minus the S of B for the vacuum state. So this is the first thing one has to do. And then the other thing is that you have to replace 2ER. One can think 2πRI. We can replace this by something nicer, because this thing, what is R for some given object? In order to give a better definition of this, we can replace this by 2π. The integral of the energy density of the object minus the energy density of vacuum. Of course, this we can renormalize to zero, and this give you a precise meaning of the energy density of the object. So this is what will replace this other thing. And then, in fact, coming back to the Bekenstein bound proof, what you get instead of 2πR, if you do the things properly, is exactly this integral here. So it means that now we have this other bound that is 2π integral. And this is the like a quantum Bekenstein bound. Quantum Bekenstein bound. And you can see easily that all these things here are solved already in this form. First of all, we don't need any boundary conditions. What is the meaning of R is given by this exact expression here, R times E. Is meaning has a nice meaning for any state, and the entropy and the energy are not global; are just these specific quantities that are related to entanglement entropy of half space. The species problem is solved because, and I will show how you can understand that, because as you increase the number of species, the entropy of the object can get to be very large, but the vacuum state will also be more entropic in the half space, because you have more and more species. And this quantity, in fact, will saturate and will not surpass this. The entropy is divergent, yes, but the difference of entropies, because there are two different states, they have the same divergent pieces, because these are only ultraviolet contribution, then this quantity is finite. So, and the energy can be negative. This quantity can be, in fact, negative. But now the entropy is an entropy difference, and then it also can be negative. So both quantities can be negative. So in principle, we have all the things in place, but now we want to have a proof. And the proof depends on a new, I'm already have a very little time, right? Sorry? 10, ah, okay, fantastic. So let me introduce this other quantity called relative entropy. Now, as in the case in the mutual information, I needed two regions. Now I need two different states. So let me define this row one. I think people put two bars here, row zero. This is the relative entropy, and this is a trace, row one, log row one. Row zero. So it's not completely symmetric between these things. This looks like an entropy, but this contains something that contains two different density matrix, so it's not reduced to any difference of entropies. It's something different. Why this is, well, let me say first of all that this quantity is very important in quantum information theory. It's a very central quantity in quantum information theory. And that this is also is always positive. It's always positive. So let me write this second density matrix here in terms of some modular Hamiltonian. This is row zero. So if I write this in this way, is just an easy calculation to put it here and to re-express this relative entropy as the difference, let me call delta, of the expectation values of the modular Hamiltonian, of the second one here, minus the difference of entropies. So this means the expectation value of k in the state 1 minus the expectation value of k in the state 0 minus the entropy of 1 minus the entropy of 0. And this is always positive. And then it's easy to see what we have to do in order to prove this. We have to use the fact that the modular Hamiltonian of the vacuum state, that is the one that appears here and appears here, is just given by exactly this same expression here. So we use that k of the vacuum state is 2 pi integral of t 0, 0. Then here we have exactly this, and on the other side we have the difference of entropies, and we get that the Bekenstein bound, then this quantum version of Bekenstein bound is correct, is always correct. So let me make some final comments about this. One important thing is that what is the difference then? What we learn from the difference between this well-defined version and that is correct from the Bekenstein bound to the ideas that suggested the first, let's say, classical version of the Bekenstein bound? First of all, this bound and this other bound coincide for generic situation. For example, if you have this thing and you have some thermal state here with some temperature that is larger than the inverse of the distance here. So temperature much larger than this. So with that, you get something very similar to the Bekenstein bound. And in these situations that these two things are very similar, both of the bounds predict that are very far from saturated. So what you get is something that is trivially true, let's say. If you make calculations, you can see that this quantity is much bigger than this one in general. And in fact, if you pull these things too far, far away, this increases while the entropy is just constant. But the difference comes from the idea of when you want to the bound to be saturated. So when it turns out to be more interesting, this bound means somehow suggests the idea that you cannot put many degrees of freedom, because if you put many degrees of freedom, you can make this thing greater and greater. So it was always thought like something like putting bounds on the number of degrees of freedom. But this tells you something very different. This is always true, and it's related to the fact that the relative entropy is positive. And relative entropy, the meaning it has is a measure of the distinguishability. Between the two states. Somehow, if it tells that if you make experiments in order to differentiate these two states, rho 0 and rho 1, and you make n experiments, the probability that you make a mistake still after n experiments is proportional to minus n and the relative entropy. So it tells you how difficult it is to differentiate two different states. So it means that when you come to saturate the bound, what it means is that the two states are no longer distinguishable. So it means, for example, if you have a lot of species, it means that your state is submerged in a bath of thermal particles, because you are in a bounded region. Then you can think that the vacuum also have a lot of fluctuations, and then you cannot distinguish easily the object from the vacuum. This is the problem. So it means that in order to distinguish the object from the vacuum, you need to put high enough energies in order that the relative entropy is much greater than zero. Okay, this is all. Thank you. Density matrix for boundary for thermal states in reduces in some regions, you say.
Well, I say in general. I mean, you can do it for some specific thermal states, right, that come from taking a reduced density matrix, but
yeah, in two dimensions you can actually compute the density matrix for conformal field theories in some in half a space or even in interval. Is also given by some integral of some function in terms of t0, 0. This is because of properties of conformal transformation. You can conformally transform the same problem, the same Hamiltonian, to other situation. But in higher dimensions, you cannot do that because the thermal case is equivalent to have one dimension compact. And then you can map in two dimensions to the cylinder that this has the thing, but in higher dimension you can map to a cylinder, but it's a sphere times time. So it's not, you don't have S1. So there is no way to map to the thermal case. So in general, even for conformal field theories and a sphere, in higher dimensions is not known the expression of the model Hamiltonian. Yeah. Well, in principle, this analytic continuation is not that you have problems at the fundamental level, in the sense of the analytic continuation is unique because these Renyi entropies are, it's not just any number, it's just powers of the eigenvalues of some density matrix that are between 0 and 1. So there is a unique thing there. For if you know the range entropy for all n, you can get the others somehow, because you can get all the eigenvalues. But a different story is if you have an expression for each n, what you get. In general, if you have an expression that is close, then you just put n, as we usually do, right? You put n, any number in your expression, that's it. But in some cases, people have been able to compute, for example, for two intervals, this works by Calabrese, Cardi, and Tony, and some other people. They compute, for example, for some conformal field theories in two dimensions, the range for two intervals for each n, but the expression depends on some matrices that grow with n, and you have to do something with these matrices, so it's very difficult. It's not like closed expression in terms of one formula, so it's difficult to understand what happens for n equal to 1. For the in that case you have to see what is a perturbation. If a perturbation is a particle very far from the boundary, then it's a large perturbation because it's like the vacuum has some temperature that goes to zero far away. So a perturbation far away, it will, for example, give you a relative entropy growing to infinity with respect to vacuum. So if your perturbation is a small, for example, a small coefficient in a with respect to a vacuum plus some state with a small coefficient, with very small coefficient, then you can actually see that the there is this thing that is called the first law of entanglement entropy, that the variation of entropy is equal to the variation of the expectation value in the modular Hamiltonian when the two states are very close to each other. So this relative entropy is always positive. So you can say if I have, for example, rho lambda and rho zero is equal to rho zero, if I compute the relative entropy between rho lambda and rho zero and I plot it here, it will be something like this, because it's always positive and it's zero when these two things are equal. So it means that the first linear term of the relative entropy is zero, and in this case, these two terms have to be equal, and this is the expression here. So if you know the modular Hamiltonian, you can compute perturbation of the entropy for states that are very near, for example, in this case, the vacuum. But you have to know the expression of the modular Hamiltonian. The form of the modular Hamiltonian for the perturbated state, you say? That's what you... Ah, okay, I don't know. I don't know if you can do that. I think it's a difficult problem, but... No, what I think is of course the picture is more complicated there, but as you get something in the limit which is independent of G, you can think all of this is the same as is a very large black hole is a Rindler space. So what you say is what is the actual picture if I take the gravitational stuff, what do you see in flat space? Well, you have to see that very near the horizon, you don't care about much of the details of the geometry. It's just very, very similar, the vacuum state to Rindle space. So when the object crosses, you have an object in half a space, and then with crosses, it's just vacuum in half a space. So I'm not interested in looking very far away, let's say, just in this region, very near the horizon. Yeah, you will get some correction, but this correction will be proportional to G. It will depend on G, on the Newton constant.
So when the Bekenstein bound relates to the subjectivity of the current entropy, or?
Well, Bekenstein bound relates to this property of positivity of the relative entropy. That is not exactly any of these things, but the relative entropy is also increasing with size, and this property is equivalent to a strong subadditivity. So strong subadditivity is difficult to sometimes to understand what it actually means, but in this thing is more like intuitive. It's just that the relative entropy that measures distinguishability will increase if you increase the size of the operator, the operator algebra that you are looking at the state. Of course, if you have more operators, you can look in more detail and you can distinguish more. So the relative entropy will be bigger. So, and this is this also implies a strong relativity. So it's a more natural, like intuitive notion. What has been done is to prove the F theorem. The F theorem in terms of entanglement entropy. The F quantity is just the constant term of the entropy of a circle in 2+1 dimensions. So as it's a constant term, it's not some logarithmical divergent term. It's something that is non-local, and it has not been, because of that, it's very tough to try to prove it without using entanglement entropy, because it should be something that depends very non-locally on the correlators. It's not easy to, even it's a non-zero quantity, even for topological theories that doesn't have long distance correlators, different from zero. So in this sense, the only proof that we have now of this F theorem is using entanglement entropy. So it's a generalization of the construction that I showed. In four dimensions, the same construction fails, and one can see from what is needed that strong subadditivity seems not to be enough to prove the F theorem in four dimensions, because it always because it's strong subadditivity is a relation between four regions, it always produces second derivatives inequalities, and with second derivatives, one cannot kill enough the divergences of the entropies to get to the interesting quantity that this A quantity that you mentioned, that is a coefficient of the logarithmic term. So up to now, we don't know how to make the proof of the C theorem in four dimensions with entanglement entropy. There is a proof using standard objects in quantum field theory by Komargowski and Schwimmer.